On this week's episode, I interview four-time NBA All-Star and Olympic gold medalist Vin Baker. Vin hails from Old Saybrook, Connecticut, and attended the University of Hartford, where he played basketball and earned All-American honors. He holds the record for all-time points scored and was then drafted eighth overall in the 1993 NBA draft by the Milwaukee Bucks. Vin scored over 11,000 points during his time in the NBA and finished his career averaging 15 points and 7 rebounds a game. He now serves as a player development consultant for the Milwaukee Bucks, as well as an analyst for Fox Sports Wisconsin's Bucks Live pre- and post-game shows. Vin and I will talk about various topics like his battle with addiction and sobriety, his book God in Starbucks, and much more. Welcome back to Through the Lens of Basketball, brought to you by True Grind Basketball. True commitment, true grind, true results. Before we get to Vin and I's conversation today, I'd like to take a moment to thank my listeners. I have been absolutely blown away from the amount of support that I've received. And that's just not from people that I know, but also from people that I've never met before that have reached out. It is truly amazing, and I cannot thank you guys enough. You guys are the sole reason I wanted to do this podcast, and it makes me very, very happy to see that I'm positively affecting people. Also, this week's podcast is a perfect example of what I've been referencing in my first couple episodes. The relationships are really what it's all about. You truly don't know who will become your friends in this industry. You can never really predict it. I could have never imagined that I'd be close with Vin, and it's just something that you can't foresee, and I think that is so cool. With that being said, I'd like to welcome Vin Baker to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, man. I appreciate you having me on the podcast. Looking forward to it, man.
So let's start off by having you give the listeners some background on you and your story.
So my story, my I like to call it my journey, started in Old Saybrook, Connecticut, small town in Connecticut, and grew up a preacher's kid. Played high school basketball for 2 years at Old Saybrook High School. Was recruited by two schools, University of Hartford and the University of Rhode Island. The University of Hartford was the only one out of the two that offered me a scholarship. So it was kind of a no-brainer. My mom simply said, "You're taking that scholarship." So a lot of people ask me why the University of Hartford. A, it's why not the University of Hartford, and B, or 1B, is it was my mother really told me I was going to take it. And so it was a great opportunity for me, a great university. It was only 45 minutes away from home. And, you know, I kind of went there, and that's where the journey began, my basketball journey.
Sure. So my first question for you would be, that's an interesting way to start your basketball career. I didn't know that about you. Only played your junior and senior year, I would imagine those are the 2 years you played. Why, what was that late start? What occurred? Just didn't get into it, or just kind of just happened that way?
Nah, yeah, I have to be honest with you, man. As I mentioned a lot in my book, you know, God in Starbucks, I was very open and honest. You know, when I reflect on my time in Old Saybrook, I was very passionate about the sport at a young age. And, you know, I played in eighth grade. It wasn't like I just blossomed. You know, I obviously became much more talented, but you know, my freshman and sophomore year, I wasn't as developed, you know, as physically. And I was only 6'2 as a freshman and grew to be about 6'4 as a sophomore. Still hadn't grown into my body, but I was still passionate, very passionate about basketball. So I didn't make the team. I made the freshman team as a freshman. I played JV as a sophomore. And so legitimately, I played varsity my junior in senior year. So okay. I had played 3 years.
But I gotcha. Okay. That makes a little more sense.
Yeah.
So let's get into a little more about the tail end of your NBA career. Like you mentioned, I mentioned in my intro, how did you overcome like that uphill battle with the addiction, and what was your mentality and outlook on your issue at hand?
Well, you know, first of all, my addiction and my alcoholism, you know, like I'm assuming most people, for me, it just kind of snuck up on me. My lifestyle, you know, being a four-time NBA All-Star, I initially started to drink and party as recreation, and not realizing that I was exposed to it because of, you know, family. And the journey became, well, the addiction became just a part of partying and kicking and hanging out. And the next thing I knew was I couldn't stop drinking. Like, I had to do it. I had to wake up and actually do it every single day because I had become addicted to alcohol. So I enjoyed so much success early in my career and gotten away from kind of my morals and my background as a kid growing up in the church, being the son of a preacher and growing up in a spiritual household. But then when I got to the pros, I kind of put that stuff aside and, you know, assumed that, you know, alcoholism, addiction, marijuana, those things wouldn't affect me. And for the first 5 or 6 years of my career, it really didn't. You know, I was an all-star 4 times. But after the 6th year, it really took a turn for the worse. And the partying, the recreational drinking turned into a habit. And so, you know, I really had to lose everything that I had gained in my career. You know, my fortune, my status as a player, my reputation. I had to lose everything to regain my life. And I'm fortunate that it happened that way.
So what do you think the turning point was? And you kind of, during that explanation there, you kind of said for 4 or 5 years, you know, it didn't affect you. Now, to me, that can mean a couple of things. Young age, you know, age or just things like that. What in your mind do you think was that turning point where it didn't affect you so much? Maybe like your play, your performance, or your life in general, and then it started affecting it. What do you think that turning point was?
So I think when I got to Seattle, my first year in Seattle, we were 61-21. I was traded there for Sean Kemp. It was my biggest year basketball wise. It's just a huge year for me statistically as a player. I grew. I was second team All NBA. I was playing with a superstar in Gary Payton, and the success was at the highest I'd ever had it. I just got my brand new sneaker from Brand Jordan, the Vindicator. I was considered one of the top 25 players in the world. So, again, it was just partying at that point. But at a certain point, we played the Lakers in the playoffs, and we lost them in the second round. And I went into this. I wouldn't say it was depression at the time, but I was really saddened by the loss, and I felt like I didn't play my very best. And so, you know, over the summertime, it just picked up. I was just like, I'm just going to drink and party and drink and party. And by the end of that summer, after my first year in Seattle, I realized that I had a real issue. It went from the recreational drinking and partying to I need to do this every single moment of the day. And that was the turning point for me, and it was, I didn't see it coming. Like most, I would assume, well, for me, I can't talk for anybody else, I didn't see mine coming. And the next thing you know, I'm an all-star basketball player and I'm an full-blown alcoholic.
Yeah, so it's interesting for me, this might be a hair off topic, just not being a former player myself, just only being in the NBA for the last 4 or 5 months in this environment, that, and I'm also observing from the outside growing up and up to this point, that they're under this crazy microscope their whole life. Every step they take, you know, Giannis plays a prank on Sterling, it's all over TV. Like, which is fine, that's just part of their life. And I feel like you don't see as much of, I don't want to say like kind of like what you did, but you, well, just listening to your explanation about you guys are in the playoffs, you're partying, things like that. Like, I'm not sure if I'm naive and think that it doesn't go on anymore, or maybe that guys aren't doing it as much. And I don't know if you could speak to that. It's just kind of, well, that's unique to me. I don't know.
Yeah, well, you know, and this is professional sports. And I'm not saying all athletes, all professional athletes, but the culture of professional sports has been about, you know, in some eras, it's been about women, drugs, alcohol, and certainly in my era, it was about those things. You know, heavy, you know, marijuana use, and you know, drinking and obviously womanizing, and I was no different. Mm-hmm. I just think the difference for me was that it became an issue, a problem. Now, I can't speak to today's athlete. The 90s are certainly different from, you know, 2018 because of the huge change of social media, Instagram, yeah. Facebook, yep. Twitter, Snapchat. I think, you know, players are obviously more guarded. And I don't know. I can't speak to say what players are doing off the court. But for me, it was really a culture that I kind of stepped into, because my goal and my intentions when I first got in the NBA wasn't to drink and smoke every day. Yeah. It just kind of happened. Mm-hmm. And I was, as opposed to being a leader, I became an estranged follower.
I got you. That makes sense. More of environment-based rather than, so a little bit lighter of a topic. Having been drafted by the Bucks here, how does it feel, or what does it mean to you to be back kind of where everything started?
Man, I can honestly say this is probably the most fulfilling part of my life from the standpoint of where I came from. Mm-hmm. And this is where it all started, in 1993, being drafted by the Milwaukee Bucks as the 8th pick. You know, I obviously got close to this city from the success that I had as an individual. Really didn't enjoy huge team success, but obviously enjoyed some individual success as a player. But coming full circle, man, it's miraculous for me in certain ways, because I didn't think I'd get a chance to be back in basketball, period. Mm-hmm. So to be back here and be a part of this organization with a great friend of mine and Coach Kidd, Greg Foster, who I played with, Coach Gerg, who I played for, and other guys that I know throughout the basketball world. Peter Fagan, the president of the Bucks, has been amazing. Barry Baum. In the city of Milwaukee, man, like, they embraced me. They feel like I'm family, and I feel like they're family. So it's just really special on every level, and certainly being a part of a terrific and talented basketball team. I mean, not everyone gets the opportunity to be around a Giannis Antetokounmpo in their lifetime, their basketball lifetime. Yeah. So I'm awarded that as well. So for every level for me, from the community, the organization, the team, the coaching staff, I'm just tremendously blessed to have this opportunity.
You know, like you mentioned, like the family part about it is just getting to know you in the last few months. I've noticed that everyone treats you with that respect, and that really put it in perspective for me, that everyone kind of treats you that way. And I didn't really ever think of it like that. To be honest, I kind of thought of it as like, oh, he's Vin Baker. That's kind of why they do that, because that's just kind of how it is for people like that. Mm-hmm. But I see what you're saying with the family thing. That I think that's a pretty cool part of it.
And so we all, and just let me just say this, we all have that one family member that's had some issues and gone through some stuff. So I think not only is that part for the older people who have kind of grown with me and seen me as a player, but I also think understanding the kids can benefit from seeing you can overcome obstacles. Like us, the young kids on the team, even you, E, like we're close now. We're like brothers. And when I see Giannis and Thon and Chris and Eric Bledsoe, like, I want to be a beacon of light of overcoming. So it's for me, it's bigger than basketball. You know what I mean? Like I'm on the staff and wins and losses, and I work at Fox Broadcasting, and it's a part of my job. But most importantly for me is showing the guys what mistakes not to make, and also saying if you do make them, you can still overcome. So, you know, I feel like it's a responsibility of mine being back here.
And that's a unique niche, too, to have that. I mean, just thinking about our staff as in general, or anybody in the NBA, 29 other teams that may not have somebody like that that can speak to that, or when they talk, that have that kind of respect, and the guys are listening.
Yeah.
On the coaching topic, so you mentioned to me before you served as summer league coach for the Bucks. Do you think coaching is anywhere in your sights, or do you have aspirations to coach at any level?
I do. Forward? Yeah, I definitely do. I'm not sure what level that is yet. This is my first full season in doing player development, so I'm not even necessarily on the sideline again. So if I had to pick a spot at some point, it would have to be player development, like outside of actually coaching. So doing something during the summer, or actually doing something what Kevin Garnett does, where I'm going to work with the bigs. But I'd also like to, at some point, look at the collegiate level. I think not only can you develop the players there, but you can develop young men. So that's I just love the game of basketball. So whatever opportunity I get, man, and to go back and teach the game, mm-hmm. I'm still competitive. Yeah. As are most people who are in the game,
yeah.
Always that you have it, I have it. That competitive nature, that's never gonna leave. So I love the thrill of victory and mm-hmm. hate the agony of defeat.
Yeah.
So I'm always going to be at the game in some level. So I'll just wait and be patient, learn what I can from this staff, and, mm-hmm. and see what the future holds.
No, I think that's super interesting, and kind of why that not a reason that I started this podcast, but mm-hmm. a reason, one of them was to get opinions from different people. And it's cool how somebody, two people that have absolutely polar opposite upbringings, mm-hmm. you, speaking of you and myself,
mm-hmm.
That our opinion about our future mm-hmm. is the exact same.
Right.
That yeah. coming from coaching in college, I was a manager or grad assistant.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I was per se coach. Mm-hmm. Like I was on the sideline, but you know what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
And when you said like you're able to like affect young men,
mm-hmm.
like that's why I like that side.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's pros to this side too. You know, there's pros and cons to both sides, just mm-hmm. like anything. I think that's really cool that people that are completely different really can have the same exact opinion on their
yeah.
future.
That, yeah.
I think that's so unique and neat. I don't know.
And it's cool because not to make this a political topic, but it's just cool from the standpoint that it connects us.
Yeah.
It's one of the sports is it connects us. It connects humanity. It connects two people from two different walks,
mm-hmm.
two different backgrounds, two different eras. I mean,
yeah.
I'm double your age almost,
yeah.
but as you alluded to, we have the same common goals. We want the same for the kids on the court. We want the same for each other. And it's just a wonderful space. It's a blessing to be in that space because,
definitely.
As you know,
yeah.
Again, not to make this political, that everyone's not functioning in that world right now, and
yeah.
All the way from the top to other places in our society,
yeah.
people aren't functioning on the same level that we have an opportunity to do every day.
Yeah, that's a good point. Like you said, just being able to have basketball
mm-hmm.
in your life is just mm-hmm. for me. Even people ask me like, "Oh, it's cool. Like, hey, you got a job in the NBA?
Mm-hmm.
That's really cool. Like, what's your end goal?"
Right.
I get that once a week from people. Like, what's your end goal?
Right.
I'm like, to be honest with you. And I honestly just figured out this answer probably since I've got the job here, because
mm-hmm.
so many people ask me, "Oh, that's really cool. Like, you got the next step. What's your goal?"
Right.
So like, I honestly just started figuring out this answer on my own, and it's a new one. I just told somebody completely random at last night's game.
Mm-hmm.
I told the guy, I said, "I don't know what my end goal is," and I think that's the coolest part about it.
Right. Right.
I don't know what it is.
Right. Right.
And that's just the truth. Like,
right.
I don't know. Like.
Right.
And a lot of people that. And I'm thinking back to like being like a freshman in college, and
mm-hmm.
people are like, "Oh, what are you gonna major?" And I'm like,
"Right,
I don't know."
Right.
Like a lot of kids like go to college and they're like, "I don't know what I want to do."
Right.
And they get like worried or they panic.
Right.
It's
right.
just fine.
Right.
It's just fine.
Right.
You're just doing just fine.
Right.
Like just relax, and just try a couple different things out. I know you need to have resources and things like that to be able to try things out, but
right.
there's things you can do.
Right.
That can help you.
Right.
But you don't need to have it all figured out at one time. And that's something for me that was even hard to come to terms with being young myself.
Right.
That honestly just figured out in the last couple of months, it's just okay.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like
right.
there's times in the past 18 months where I'm sitting there thinking to myself, man, like, what am I doing? Like,
right.
is this really what I should do? Or this or that or the other? And then just at a certain point it clicks and it's just like, just okay.
Yeah.
Like, whatever you're doing is fine.
Right. And that's to piggyback that and to add to that, E, like, that's the beauty of sport. That's the beauty of what we do is sometimes when I come in here and see my good friend Jason Kidd, like, from a basketball standpoint, he's accomplished everything.
Yeah.
He's been an Olympian multiple times. He's a Hall of Fame basketball player, one of the top five greatest point guards in the game. You know, there's not a lot he has not accomplished in the sport yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
when he comes in here on a day-to-day basis, the wins, the victories, the agony of defeat, all those things still burn.
Yeah.
They make him want more. And that's the beauty of basketball. It's the beauty of sport. That the championships, I always talk to young kids about, you know, everyone wants to get down. I hear people talk down on LeBron James. Well, he didn't have the killer instinct. The thing that kind of blows me away with the whole notion of that is, from a human nature sport, you have to understand that this young man is accomplished. He doesn't ever have to play basketball again.
Yeah.
There's nothing he has to do in life that has to do with conditioning, making baskets, winning championships, being an MVP, being an all-star. He's done it multiple times.
Yeah.
So when people talk about killer instinct with guys like him, I'm like, killer instinct? This guy can walk away from the sport and never look back. Why is he living under a blood, sweat, and tears creed at the age of 32 and 33 when he's probably worth $1 billion? See, don't talk about killer stuff to me when you talk about when guys come here and lay it on the line. I think from the outside looking in, sometimes it's they're spoiled, they're this, they're that. And I'm in the gym with kids every day that really care about winning, care about losing. Giannis Antetokounmpo is so refreshing to be around. The kid cares. You won't know he signed what he signed for with Nike. You wouldn't know he signed what he signed for with the Bucks. So it's just amazing to be around the sport. And it's a $1 billion business, but there's days you come in, again, the wins and losses take you right back to when you were in fifth and fourth grade at the AAU tournament, man. It's wonderful to be a part of.
Yeah, something I mentioned in my intro podcast that kind of alluding to just introducing myself to people and why I was doing it was that, you know, I get to coach basketball or be around basketball every day and watch film every day and do my job, whatever my role is here. And, you know, it's a special thing because really what basketball is, and it's kind of a funny term, is basketball is just a kid's game that adults get to play and coach. Like, I get paid to watch basketball.
Right.
To break down film.
Right.
Give it to the coaches.
Right.
Help out with the workouts on the court.
Right.
There's little kids out there just dribbling the ball and shooting it too.
Yep.
Like, that's cool. I don't know. That's like you said, refreshing.
Mm-hmm.
That's what brought that thought in my mind. That's refreshing to me that, like, kids play this game.
Yep.
Because of people, not, I would say I don't put the ball in the hoop, but people like we work with every day.
Right. Right. No, it's awesome. And there's so much, you know, opportunity. You know, obviously from the sport and the business of it, but there's just so many opportunities, as you alluded to earlier, E, to connect on so many cool levels, man.
Yeah.
You know, I, you know, me being a former all-star with the Bucks, now I'm in the gym with Giannis, and to watch his ability, to watch his skill level, and to communicate with him and add a little wrinkle here and there, it's just awesome.
Yeah.
Couldn't probably ask for a better job at this particular juncture of my life.
Definitely. So let's switch gears a little bit. I understand during your recovery you found some comfort in religion.
Mm-hmm.
Explain to me and the listeners how that quickly became the differentiator in your recovery, and how was that like your strength in overcoming obstacles and adversity, like on the road of recovery? Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's still going to be obstacles and adversity on that road once you turn that corner.
Well, for me, turning the corner, God was everything for me. Like, I grew up in the church. My father's a pastor. He's still a pastor today. And I grew up from it. I grew up in it. And when I strayed away, when I got into a point in the NBA and I fell down, I knew that there was a place I could come back to. That was home. Church was home for me. And I feel like in some ways I went through this massive and epic fall to get me back to where I was originally, and that's a child of God. So it meant everything to me. Like, I wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for my belief system and my values and my faith. You know, I love to sing privately a lot of songs, gospel songs that really, you know, resonate in my journey. He saw the best in me, You know, we fall down, but we get up. Rebuild me. Things are turning around. Like, these are some of the gospel songs that really got, like, sat in my spirit when I was really going through it. And not only did it play a part in my redemptive story, it's the wheels that turn my day-to-day sobriety. I'll be 7 years sober April 17th of this year. So it meant everything to me. I went to detox for 4 days when the way I was going, I probably should have gone for 3 months. But I had made up in my mind spiritually that I didn't want to die and that I was going to turn my life around. So once I made up my mind spiritually, all I needed to go is do is take care of the physical part, because I knew I had dialed in spiritually. So, you know, since I, you know, got sober 7 years ago, I've been hitting the ground running, you know, praying, reading, ministering, Bible studies, and it just really strengthens me every single day to, you know, stay on this road of sobriety.
That's awesome. I think everyone needs that. I don't know if I want to call it a crutch, but everyone needs that shoulder to lean on, or to get, like you said, the roots to get back to.
Yeah.
And like I said, everybody needs that, and then it takes like a rock bottom to hit before they kind of realize maybe what that shoulder or root is that they need to get back to.
Right. And when you lose what I lost, and I had this conversation. I was actually speaking to a group a couple of nights ago, a group of young people and a group of older people in a church here in Milwaukee. And the one thing I always talk about when you talk about God, people make it this mystical thing. And
sure. And
it's very difficult. It's like, read the Bible for what? Pray for what? Have faith. It sounds like fluff to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. But the one thing I can like make tangible to people who wouldn't know or don't feel that way is, my circumstances didn't change when I started praying or when I went back to church. My perspective changed. Like, that's going to change immediately. Your perspective will change. And that's what helped me, you know, get back on the right road.
Yeah, that's interesting. We don't make it a spiritual conversation, right. But, you know, I'm a man of God.
Mm-hmm.
I wear a chain around my neck every day with a cross on it.
Mm-hmm.
To hear somebody like you say about perspective, that's special.
You know, it's, I mean, tangible.
It's real. Yeah, like, it's real, rather than trying to find that whatever that like you said, mystical, trying to find it in thin air.
Right.
It's more of this, like, it changes your outlook.
Right. Your outlook. Yeah. Yep.
So like earlier in the conversation, you mentioned your book, God and Starbucks. Mm-hmm. Why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about that?
So God and Starbucks, the story or the title of it originated because I went to, about 3 years ago, I went to work at Starbucks in Rhode Island, in Kingston, Rhode Island. And, you know, no one really attached the story to the fact that my former boss with the Seattle Supersonics was Howard Schultz, the CEO of Starbucks. And so when I'd spoken to him and we had been talking, and one of the things on my journey in trying to turn this whole story around and make it complete, you know, because I'd lost so much, was to start working again. And so I reached out to Howard, who was a very good friend of mine. And that was one of the plans, is to get me into the store and manage one of the stores. So that's the title, God and Starbucks. And where most people talk about what I lost, $100 million, and now he's a barista, which is a miraculous story. And you can look at it any way you want to look at it. But from my perspective, when I went to work at Starbucks, it was game-changing for me. It taught me humility. It was actually like an upswing for me, because where I was dying.
Sure.
I literally was close. I was knocking on the doors of death. And so that was like a huge come up for me to be working at Starbucks. I learned so much. I didn't learn how to make every drink there. Like, I only learned how to make five of them. Like, and that four of those were just the coffees that we brewed. But I did learn humility. I learned who I was. I learned that my intestinal fortitude was real.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got the opportunity to write the book and just share the journey. It was funny because there's so much in the book. I just was open and candid and just told every story as I remembered it. So some of them are very, very cutting edge.
Yeah.
And we played the Golden State Warriors here maybe last week.
Yeah.
And I'm in the hallway after the game, just kind of walking randomly in the hallway, and I run into Klay Thompson. And Klay was like, I'm halfway through your book, and man, I didn't realize those guys were that crazy. So it was just funny hearing someone else's perspective and reading the book. But it was just, you know, I had a platform, and you know, I hope that people who read it will get the opportunity to see and connect on every level, from the highest mountain to the lowest valley, man. Like, I talk about everything on my road to recovery.
Sure, and I think I'm sure a lot of people appreciate the honesty and the truth that you alluded to, that you used in the book, that maybe a lot of people don't use because they're afraid of letting the truth out. I think that's an admirable thing on your part to be able to put that out there.
Yeah, you have to. You have to. For me, it was important to, you know, open up and be honest, because in recovery, that's the one thing you've got to hang your hat on.
Yeah,
is being honest. You know, there's some things that, to be perfectly honest with you, you know, I wish I could pull back from the book, just because the book is about me, and the people that, you know, that I wrote it with wanted to just open up about everything. And but I'm grateful that I cleansed myself in some ways. You know, I didn't tuck anything. You know, you don't have to go back and say, you left that out, and what about this? And so people, you know, people can relate, man. I'm talking to a world of recovery.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not talking to NBA fans. I'm talking to a world of recovery. So.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So last but not least, what advice do you have for listeners who may be looking to get their foot in the door, kind of much like you did? And obviously, you come, you know, they know your story and former NBA player and whatnot, but to prove themselves and move up the ladder, both in the everyday world, but also in the sports industry.
Well, you know, one of the cool sayings that I've heard since being back in the pros is, and it refers to the San Antonio Spurs, and they talk about Greg Popovich saying that he only wants players who are over themselves. Right? Like, he wants players that kind of are done with the money and the fame and the fort and kind of are over themselves. And if you're trying to get anywhere in life, it's whether it's here in the NBA with a job or anywhere, got to get over yourself. You know, I had to, when I walked in and put on that green apron at Starbucks, I wasn't thinking about my four-time NBA All-Stars or my brand Jordan. I was over myself. And and I was humble. And that's the biggest thing, man. Get over yourself. A, two, have probably one, have faith and believe that you can do it. You know, really believe that you can, what you set your mind to do, which sounds like fluff and sounds like cliche, but if you put your mind to it,
it's not,
you can do it.
Yeah.
I think what most people don't want to do is have patience and work through the downs, the ups. So that's my biggest message, man. Like, from coming from Old Saybrook High School all the way to second team all NBA and an Olympian, to losing everything and then coming back to the NBA, my message is real, man. Intestinal fortitude, believing, working hard at something, getting over yourself, it works. Because I'm not the superstar, all-star basketball player. I've been broken, man. And I think that's the most important message I can send out there.
You know, one thing that I've been told in the last few years, just overhearing from head coaches I've worked for, like, and Jason hasn't really said it because it's a little bit different in the pros, but under my head coach in college, Coach Dambrot, he would always say, no one's bigger than the program. And I think that's what popped into my head when you said about getting over yourself, that, like, why the Spurs have such longevity is that no one's bigger than, I don't know if anyone's bigger than, like, R.C. Buford and Popovich, because it's, I don't really know if I refer to, like, the NBA as, like, a program.
Right.
It is.
Right.
But it's, that's not probably the right term.
Right.
No one's bigger than the organization.
Right.
They could replace me in 5 seconds.
Right. Right.
Like, so I got to walk in here every day thinking that someone's on my ass going to replace me. And to be honest with you, I think that's the reason why, that separates people from being successful and not successful, that there are, someone's always chasing.
Right.
Like for me, and this is just me speaking from my current situation, there's 30 NBA teams,
mm-hmm.
and there's 30 dudes that are probably in my position in the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
But there's about 30,000 that wish they were.
Yep.
And them 30,000 dudes are coming.
Yeah.
Of those 30,000, 15,000 really want it, and 7,000 are coming.
Yeah.
So I better wake up and get here and do something.
Yep. Yeah.
Because if I don't, then that 7,000 are coming.
Yeah.
Hot.
Yeah.
Because they want it bad. And I know because people hit me up. People hit everybody up.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's how I got it.
Mm-hmm.
I hit people up.
Mm-hmm.
And I was one of those 7,000.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I get it.
Yeah.
So that's what, like, when you're saying get over yourself.
Right.
So, like, okay, now, like, I got it. All right, now get over yourself.
Right.
Quick.
Right. Because, and we can share this, E, we're in the NBA.
Yeah.
But there's a distance, a huge gap between where you and I stand and where Jason Kidd is.
Definitely.
But there's an opportunity there.
Yeah.
So once you're here, you understand. Like if I see Giannis Antetokounmpo come in and he's busting his butt when he doesn't have to, based on what society says, what his contract is, I got to come here and bust my butt.
Sure.
Right?
He's
and so,
yeah.
You know what I mean? Like you said, E, there's people all, if you're not going to do it, there are, and I'm going to double your number, there's 50,000 people
exactly,
out there ready and willing to do it. So
you're
accurate on that.
Well, I think that's about it for today. I really appreciate you taking the time to sit down with me. And
we're brothers, man.
Yeah.
Anytime. Thanks for having
me. Awesome.
E. Thanks.
Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. You can subscribe to my podcast through the Apple iTunes podcast app, as well as leave a review there. You can also follow us on Twitter at TTLB Podcast. That's TTLB Podcast on Twitter. Feel free to submit questions and or feedback via Twitter, and I will be sure to answer them during my next episode. Until next time.